Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio, and boy, we've got a show this week. Out in Las Vegas, we have recorded Bob Heil's latest audio seminar for all of you amateur radio operators and audio enthusiasts that would like to catch up on what's new. And he and Chip were both there presenting and showing off not just microphones, but giving, you know, demonstrations of how the audio works and whatnot. And this was all done at the Las Vegas Amateur Radio Club's meeting. I don't know if this was a regular meeting of theirs or if this was something they scheduled special, but they were the host of the Heil Seminar, the Las Vegas Amateur Radio Club. And K4ULL, who was the president, and the vice president, K4HMV. I want to make sure I get these call signs right. You know how I am. What a radio club. I'm telling you what. You know, I could not believe these guys. I've been to a lot of meetings. And, you know, I'll tell you, if you want to see a model for an amateur radio club, these guys, this is the place to go. The president got up and he did some stand-up comedy prior to the meeting. There was no stuffiness anywhere in the room. I think they'd have ran the stuffiness out if there was any at all. But it was absolutely a fantastic group of guys. And coupling that up with Bob and Chip presenting the audio seminar, it was really unbelievable. We've got it coming up. We recorded it. It's coming up live. And then, of course, in Las Vegas, they had the amateur radio reception as part of the National Association of Broadcasters event, the NAB, which we attended. And at that time, the American Radio Relay League presented me with the 2008 Bill Leonard Media Award, and my goodness, that's just that was just really wonderful. Alan Pitts was there, and a number of the other fellows from the ARRL. I'll tell you, what a group. And I will say this, you know, I get on a soapbox, I can't help it, but I just want to encourage folks to be sure to join, be a league member. With as many things that are going on in the communications world today, and all of us amateurs, we all need to pull together. And, you know, I think a lot of times people are not members of the league only because they just don't think about it. I mean, you know, you see the books, you've got four or five amateur radio handbooks. You've probably got a bunch of old QSTs. Subscription runs out. And as busy as folks are, it just slips the mind. But be sure and renew and keep up with a lot of good stuff. Now in QST, they've evidently changed the format of the magazine some over the last months or year. I find QST extremely interesting to read. And I of course, I collect them. And we've got a whole collection of them here. Matt and David have archived all these old QSTs. Now I understand the league has them online, which is... I haven't even tried that yet, but that's phenomenal. But I want to say thank you to everybody that's participated with QSO, because the Leonard Media Award is an accomplishment only of the folks that have participated in this radio show. It's not anything I've done. It's all the interesting people that's been on the air and spent your time putting up with me for an hour or so as we explore all the various realms of amateur radio. Well, let's get to it right now. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back from Las Vegas and the Las Vegas Amateur Radio Club and the Heil Audio Seminar. Also, right after that, Linda Moulton Howe will give us the latest on the sunspots, what's going on with Brother Soul here. Coming up on QSO. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. And now, ladies and gentlemen, from Las Vegas, Nevada, hosted by the Las Vegas Amateur Radio Club. It's the Bob Heil Audio Seminar.
Put side is the output side. This is an antenna, and we're going to tell you all about that tonight. And it's particularly fitting, I think, that we have so many knowledgeable experts up here with this grouping tonight. You know, we are at the bottom of the sunspot cycle, and conditions are the pits. Or if you want to look at it another way, conditions have gone to Heil. And what do you do about that? Well, you probably need a taller tower, and you can buy that from Luke Rohn. So hail, hail, the gang's all here, and it's a real pleasure to be before you tonight. Yeah, the antenna on the input side of the radio is a very important thing. It's, the same kinds of things are critical to performance. Frequency response, pattern, impedance, drive level, all the kinds of things that we worry about. Gain on an antenna and front-to-back ratio, these apply to the input side just like the output side. And the frequency response part is particularly critical. Many, many decades ago, back in the 20s, the telephone company did research into human hearing. And they were looking to figure out how and why we hear the things we do and in what way they can improve the throughput, to use a modern digital mode expression, improve the throughput on telephone company circuits. Well, we have to go back many, many, many millennia in human history to think about how this all came about. I have to think about Uncle Ugog sitting in a cave many, many, you know, millions of years ago, perhaps. Uncle Ugog is sitting there nodding off. You know, he just got done playing cards or whatever Uncle Ugog did in his cave. And he hears off somewhere off in the distance, boop, boop, boop. And Uncle Ugog thought about that for a second. He said, no, that's a bullfrog. That's not a predator. Uncle Ugog went back to sleep. A little while later, Uncle Ugog is still nodding off there, and he hears, Uncle Ugog got, oh, this is bad news. That's a saber-toothed cat. And Uncle Ugog ran away to reproduce another day, if you will, without getting too graphic about it. But you think about what happened. Cousin Mork did not run away. The saber-toothed tiger got Uncle Mork. And Uncle Ugog's side of the gene pool continued and continued. Well, that in the high frequency spectrum is what this is all about. We have developed with a sensitivity to high frequencies, particularly at low listening levels. When signals are loud on the air, you'd like to listen to these guys with high fidelity. Oh, it just sounds great. Oh, big signals, nice wide fidelity. It sounds gorgeous. But when signals are tough, that same fidelity goes nowhere. and his telephone company research that showed that at very low listening levels, we are up to 40 dB more sensitive in the range of about 1,500 hertz up to about 6,000, 7,000 hertz, but particularly in that area about 2,000, 3,000 hertz. Now, of course, our SSB envelope is about 300 to 2,700 hertz. So what do we do? How do we enhance our signal, especially if we're trying to work that station in Mongolia and conditions are tough? That is going to be our quest tonight. And the person that's going to lead the discussion here in just a couple of minutes is a renowned radio amateur. He is both in the CQ Amateur Radio Hall of Fame, and in a few minutes you'll see his contribution to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as well. We have a brief video we'd like to share with you right now, and we'll get some lights dimmed and tell you a little bit about Mr. Bob Heil.
We'll be right back to the Bob Heil Audio Seminar in Las Vegas, Nevada, right after this. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. And now back to the Bob Heil Audio Seminar, recorded in Las Vegas, Nevada, as hosted by the Las Vegas Amateur Radio Club.
Thank you. If you ever get a chance to go to Cleveland, I really recommend that you go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's a fantastic experience overall. You go up through the main lobby and go up this escalator, and you will run right into the Heil sound display there. You can't miss it. It's the only thing that's bigger on that second floor is Mama Cass's dress. But you think about it. This is a fellow that was working with the biggest rock groups in the world, right in the center of the media, and anybody that, you know, was anybody was dealing with this fellow, and he left it all to come back to amateur radio, his first love. Ladies and gentlemen, my boss, my dear friend, Mr. Bob Heil, K9EID.
Thank you. Thank you. I always love being in front of a crowd of ham radio operators because this is how I learned all of this. I really have a lot of fun when I get in front of engineers. I was with about 60 of them today over at Studio Instrument Rentals. They showed our drum kit that we've been working on for 2 years. The world has not seen it. And so we had all of these great engineers from all the different casinos to hear our new microphones and see the new drum kit and all that. And I must have answered the question at least 20 times today. What school did you go to? How'd you learn all this? What school did you go to? And then when I tell them that I learned everything from amateur radio, they kind of like, oh, that CB stuff? No. It's like a great big open door that I can then get on my platform and do my 10-minute rah-rah speech about ham radio and all of the things at Katrina and all the disasters, and where would you be if we didn't have us to do your phone lines when all the poles are laying on the ground? You know the whole story. And it's really true. I started when I was 15 years old. My folks bought me a Harvey Wells TBS 50D. It's still on the air. I still have it on the air. My 20A I built as a kit in 1958. It's still on the air. It was a phasing rig. I learned so much about that project and then that big antenna project. And we've absolutely brought new technology to the industry And it was all because of those phasing projects. Where are the colleges? Where are the instructors? Are you not listening? Do you not understand phasing? Obviously so. I pulled this demonstration today for these engineers. You would think that all of these great casinos that have these engineers in charge of all the audio would understand it. Only about three of them really understood it. I couldn't believe it. And it happens to me every time I get to speak in front of an audience because I do the same thing over and over. And I am amazed how many people don't understand how our life is governed by phasing. Everything you do in ham radio is governed by that. So we're going to get into that in a little bit. But so much of the stuff that is done today started with ham radio. We wouldn't have television. You wouldn't have satellite TV. You wouldn't have VCRs, on and on and on, because it was a ham. No is not in our vocabulary. We'll try anything. So we blow it up and have a lot of smoke and all that. That's part of the darn fun, you know. Just run that sucker till the plates are red hot and then the envelope breaks and it's start all over. But that's how we did it. And that's how I still do it. And so it's all of this fun stuff we get to do. I'm still on the air. I'm on the air a lot. I have a remote that I use from back in Illinois when I'm out here, and it really works for me. The TS-480 is amazing radio because it take it out of a box and you stick two cables in your computer and go. And you can talk to it anywhere. You don't have to be a computer genius to make it work. And it runs great. So I'm very excited to have that. And Walsh and I use it when we're out on tour. And it beats throwing wires out of an antenna wire out of a hotel. I'll tell you a neat little story about that. One night, after the show, we get on the top floor all the time so we can have a longer wire. And you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and Joe says, "Man, we need a weight on the end of this thing." Oh, wait a minute. He goes out in the hall, and somebody down the hall had one of those big silver things they put over the plates, you know, when they give you your dinner. So he ties the wire. I mean, that was great. A great idea. So we pitched out the window, and we start listening around. He's calling a few guys. Wow, this works pretty good. All of a sudden, a big bang on the door. We go to the door, and here's this great big security officer, would you like to explain to me what you gentlemen are doing in this room? And, Joe said, we've got my ham radio here, and we're just talking to some people. Yeah, well, the guys down on the 10th floor keep having this thing bang at their window. So I guess we should have tied a rubber ball on it or something. I don't know.
I drew sparks last time I drew that. It was great fun.
It was a great fun. Oh, good deal. Well, anyway, it's just this crazy thing that we do. And, I got off the road in 1980. I just got about 15 years of traveling and doing all these crazy things. Here's a guy that has never tasted beer. I've never smoked a cigarette, and I'm running around all these crazy drug addicts. But like Townsend used to say, he said, that's okay. That's okay. The guy's got a soldering iron, and he makes us sound good, and oh, yeah, he can drive the truck. So, you know, while they're out partying and doing their stuff, I'm on stage winding cables properly. There is a proper way to wind cables. We want to come back next week and have a session on that. But anyway, I just got tired of being on the road. I came back, and I turned on my KWM2, and it's like, what the hell happened here? In the 12 years that I had been running down the road, I'm going, wait a minute. I couldn't understand anything. What was going on with this stuff? And what I discovered is, I got my new Kenwood here, and I got my MC50 going. Oh. There was no articulation. And I'm going, what happened here? Because when I left it, Art Collins' great audio of 1.8 and 2.1 wide had went out the window, and that was 2.4, and it was all a bunch of bass drums, and nobody could understand it. Oh, but it was a matching microphone. It was painted the same color as the radio. Had a name on it, too. Didn't come from the same company, but who you don't know that, you didn't know that, and you paid a lot of money for it, and it's like, wait a minute. So I started experimenting. And I learned some things about that antenna and from Paul Klipsch, how to build bass cabinets and tune things. And I came up with this neat little passive element. I hate condensers. We don't need phantom power. We don't need powered microphones. We need good dynamic microphones that do the right thing. But we hadn't had them. So I took this little element, and thinking of what Paul had taught me about how to tune a bass cabinet, I tuned the element. There's a little labyrinth inside the HC element. And it was a unique thing. And so now we have microphone elements that really made articulation come alive, and we didn't have to have any kind of EQ. It was great. And that started a whole run of me getting so excited about changing the microphone situation, which changed the entire sound of the radios. I can tune around on the band today, and I can tell you that microphone from another. And the guys that have it right, the right balance of highs and lows, those are the guys that get through the pileups.
We'll be right back to the Bob Heil Audio Seminar in Las Vegas, Nevada, right after this. Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews. Or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out. transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. And now back to the Bob Heil Audio Seminar, recorded in Las Vegas, Nevada, as hosted by the Las Vegas Amateur Radio Club.
And I go back again to some of my early days that we used to play so much with things like Pink Noise and all the different things that the telephone company did. The telephone company did some marvelous things. What they discovered was a thing that, come on here, see what happens when you put phantom power on things. Phantom power is awful. Come on here, cut it out. There we go. Be quiet. It'll be through in a minute. The deal is that the telephone company learned in a process of several years how our ears hear. Because when they started the telephone company, they had the same problem. They couldn't understand the words. And they're going, what's going on? All the electronics worked. We had two wires from New York to California. And the voltage was right. But what happened? Dr. Fletcher and Dr. Munson did a big study on our ears and discovered it's us, our ears. Various levels of audio have different sensitivities. And if you listen to things at lower levels, it's totally different than it is at higher levels. That's why the young kids like their music so loud. Because at about 130 dB, our ears are absolutely flat. We can hear all the cymbals, all the bass, all the mid-range, all the vocals, all the words. But down at 70 dB, you're having a tough time trying to pull each of those out. You have a loudness button on a lot of your radios. What does that do? It tries to electronically lift that up and make it level at low levels. It does a job, but not a great job. So then we have to get into equalization. We have to look at things, listen to things. And once again, listening is lost. It really got lost 15 years ago. It's all about ego and brands and whoa, this, that. No, man, listen. Just listen. Listening is a mental process. And when you listen, you'll hear things that the spec sheets don't tell you. That the ego that, oh, I bought this thing from because it's a big ad in a magazine. Oh, good for you. But is it right? Here is just a magnificent demonstration of what we're talking about. What's going on here? These are all the same level of tones. Notice what happens in the mid-range. It's going to run again. Now watch what happens to the level, especially the low end. Very important. All the same level. Which ones could you hear better? You know which ones you could hear better. The mid-range, because you're more sensitive there. You could hardly hear the low end. But if you would look at my meters and look at the recording, it's there. It's all there. It's you. It's what you're listening to, your system, either your ears, your speakers, your amplifiers. They have to be readjusted to hear it flat. And that's what we did with the microphone industry. We changed it. And now we're looking at things to get us through noise. And we've got some more fabulous demonstrations that Chip will get into here in a little bit that really help. Understand what we're doing. That's the whole thing. We're trying to figure out what we're doing. I carried this probably a little too far because Joe a few years ago says, why don't you build me a better microphone? Well, I hadn't looked. When I left in 1980, I didn't look back. And I didn't know that all of the big-time names you hear are now being made in Mexico and China. And it's really sad. Oh, my God, is it sad when you listen to some of the stuff that's coming out of these big companies today. It's not the same as it was in 1970. It's really, really sad. And just to prove some of that, again, we're listening to a system that's flat. Anybody who think I'm playing games, you come up here and you'll find out. We are absolutely flat.
It has gorgeous articulation, but yet it's got the right balance of highs and lows. The balance is important. I hear so many of these guys on today, they're doing hi-fi single sideband. I don't know what that is. And I am a lot of times blamed for starting it because I came out with microphones that had nice big low end. But these guys took it to excess. They went and buy $30,000 worth of processors and equalizers to try to make it sound like Art Bell. Well, I'm sorry. We're talking about 3K bandwidth. Now, if some of them want to get to be 6 and 8 wide, then that's another situation that we'll have another discussion on another time about. But this microphone can do a lot of things. And if you don't take care, you can get it to sound terrible. You can't understand what I'm saying. And it's all about the right balance of highs and lows. And in today's world, almost every transceiver allows us to do that. There's the sound of the microphone itself, and it's very balanced. Nice highs, nice lows. Now, I hear a lot of these things, these desk mics and things that guys use, and it's like, it's not good. First of all, they get this far away. What just happened? Every time you double the distance, you lose 6 decibel. Every time you do that, you lose it. So then you crank up the gain. What do you hear? Your blowers, the kids next door, the dogs in the neighborhood, and your fans. I hear guys every once in a while call me, God, I'm picking all kinds of background noise. If you're picking up background noise, number one, you're not watching what's going on here. You're not talking in the microphone properly. You're too far away. You've got the gain way too high. And, of course, if you talk up in it, you don't need the gain that high. So learn to use your microphone. You do not want to be that far away. And if you are, you come and see me afterwards, and we're going to talk. That's why we develop some really cool things, booms, that you can pull right up to you, and you don't lose that 6 and 8 and 10 dB. It's just amazing to me how many people do not understand what they lose when we talk about 6 and 8 and 10 dB. The next 5 minutes, you're never going to forget in your whole life, because we're going to show you some things in a demonstration that's going to bring so many things home. We could be here for 3 or 4 hours talking about what's about to happen. What we're talking about, it's nothing but phasing. It's great. I mean, really great. What we're going to do, well, 3 dB. You know that if your signal's not making it, and you guys figure, wow, I'll double my power. I got a 1,000 watt amp. I'm going to go buy me a 2,000 watt amp. Don't tell the guys in Washington. After all, Riley's gone. Nobody's listening. You know what happens when you add that double your power? I don't care if it's 500 to 100. If it's 1 to 2, same deal. Here's what happens. These are two microphones in phase. And when I bring this up to this is not a magic act. This is science. When I bring this up here, it's going to be adding 1,000 watts. So you might want to cover your ears because it's going to get pretty loud, right? There's both of them. Oh, now wait a minute, Heil. My amplifier's a hell of a lot louder than that. I got news for you. It's not. I'm going to take away 3 decibels. I'm going from 500 watts to 250 watts. There it went. Did you hear it? Remember what I said a while ago about listening? Close your eyes. I mean, let's really get serious about this, because this is serious stuff. This is not a magic act. This is a science experiment. On three, I'm going to take away half the power. 1, 2, 3. Did you hear it? It is so slight. Is it worth $2,000 or $3,000? How about if I gave you a microphone that gave you 10 dB? Aha. Well, you see, now you got to think about this. Then we take this magic little plug. I wired it backwards. 10^2 is to 3, 3 is to 2. So this microphone is now out of phase. Well, what the heck is this? Is this some kind of Kreskin deal? No. It's just out of phase. You know what's going to happen when I talk into both of them? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Nothing. Think about that for a minute. Nothing. Now, do you know how your Yagi works? I bet you don't. How many people could put a $1,000 bill on the table and tell me exactly what Yagi did? Dr. Yagi did it. You don't count.
And you don't pay me enough to have a $1,000 bill.
That's right. The deal is you have a driven element. Mathematically, you put a director out. I got 3 dB. Then you put a second one. I get 6 dB. And on and on and on and on. But then, mathematically, you figure out how to put one behind, out of phase. Aha. That front-to-back ratio. You're looking at an antenna. Chip said that a while ago, and you know, I just let it pass over your head that we're talking into an antenna. We are. It has a pattern. It has frequency response. It's an antenna. And it's really what made my life was that 128 element experience, making all those babies phased, in phase. It was a monumental thing. Building the 20A. How do you get rid of the carrier?
Out of phase.
How do you get rid of the other sideband? Out of phase. You got your little handy talkie, and all of a sudden you stand here and you lost the signal. What happened? Well, I don't know what happened. Well, I do. You're not getting just a signal from an antenna to an antenna. You're getting 500 signals, and a couple of them are bouncing over off a water tower, and they come into your antenna on your little handy dandy. Out of phase. Hello, you got no signal. You move just a little bit and you're back in phase. That's how it works. Everything you do in ham radio is developed along the lines of phasing. Everything. And you need to experiment with some of this. Get into it. It's amazing what you can do. How many people have phase dipoles on 40 meters or anywhere? Pretty cool, isn't it? Pretty cool. Let me tell you, if you live in the Midwest, it's ultimate cool because you can flip a switch and you can go California or you can go Florida. It's amazing just by changing the phasing of those two arrays. It's so simple. It just boggles my mind that we don't hear more about it. I think it should be question number one or two in the question pool. I think we need to learn more about this stuff than some of the things they're trying to do on the test today. We're not trying to be Einstein here. We want to know what affects us. These are the things that affect us. And it's not something that I dream up. It's what happens. It's science. And the science is so simple, but I never read about it. And it really affects what you're doing in the audio world. One of the other things we did.
We'll be right back to the Bob Heil Audio Seminar in Las Vegas, Nevada, right after this. Week after week, you hear us talk about Transworld antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. As you're listening to this broadcast recorded in Las Vegas, Nevada, the Bob Heil Audio Seminar, keep in mind one thing, and that is if you hear pauses or there all of a sudden the audio disappears or it sounds a little disjointed, it's because Bob is disconnecting microphones and connecting microphones. And we were connected to the PA system, Mike. And you're not, so when he disconnects a mic, it goes dead. We in the room could still hear him talking, but you'll notice a few things like that. Well, it's not bad, but believe me, you're going to enjoy listening to this seminar. The other thing is this, we are on iTunes. If you're listening by means of shortwave radio, you can get this broadcast in the form of a podcast off of iTunes and, of course, off of our website as well. And what I'm going to do is I'm putting this up on iTunes and on our website, minus any audio processing. That way you can hear the full effect of all the things that Bob is doing. So let's get back to Las Vegas, Nevada, and Bob Heil's audio seminar.
You wanted me to build him a better microphone, and I did. This is an amazing microphone. It's taken over the pro world. We just had a summer and a fall, a whole from May on. Stevie Wonder's throwing out all of his microphones. They're all Heil on their stage. Don't believe me? Go buy his new DVD, Live at Last. They've been bugging him for years to do a live DVD, and he did. It's a big advertisement for Heil Sound because this is his microphone for vocals. This is his microphone for horns and overheads. And it's just so rewarding to me to have artists like him and Joe and Paul Rogers. I could name you about 50 of them. And it's just absolutely wonderful. But they were all done because of ham radio. This one is very special. Because of what I learned in my phasing experiments, we did something that's never been done, ever. We built a microphone that you talk in the end of it, and you've got all these things down the side. Usually these condensers, you talk in the side of them. Because you don't want condensers. You heard what happens when you try to turn phantom power onto some of this stuff. You don't need phantom power. You need good dynamics, but nobody until now has built anything that was decent. But here's where we really turn the corner. Every microphone has a little slot in the side, four of them. And what's in the background enters that out of phase. So maybe you get 10, 15 dB of rear rejection. I said, that's not enough. Joe said, it's not enough. Do it right. So we did. We have all of this entrance instead of four little holes. And all of this side and rear comes in to the back of the microphone. And guess what happens? Nothing. That is an impressive demonstration because there's nothing coming out of the back of this microphone. Never been done before. So all the recording guys, the live guys, and ham radio guys, because now we get rid of all your noise. It's very simple. I took that same thing and put it in the new 781. What a great piece for ham radio. It's a great microphone. It's this microphone that I've rolled the low end off just a little bit so that it doesn't have so many lows. We don't need lows in our ham radio market, and it's just sensational. So we just keep going. We keep trying to make it better. And I think we've accomplished a whole lot, and it's all been because of my crazy ham radio background. Chip's going to really get into some here in a minute. I got one other thing to show you. My good friend, of course, sitting at his kitchen table one day says, "Hey, Bob, you need to build me a microphone. It'll look like the front end of a 48 Pontiac." You can just hear Joe saying that, and so I did. It's a 1931, 32 Turner, the top of it. So I stole that design. I put it on our Heritage bottom, and I thought, wow, that's good. We put our PR20 element in it. Most of these things, they look really cool that the other manufacturers make, but they sound terrible. These things don't. We got guys, you go up on YouTube right now, you can see about 6 or 8 videos using the Heil Finn. Because I did one other thing, I lit it up. Joel went nuts. Well, so did ZZ Top and a whole bunch of other guys that are using it because it's fun. And if you don't have fun, don't get in front of me because I don't want to hear about it. Now, it's got to be right. The science has got to be there, but it's got to be a lot of fun. And that's what we do, and we just keep going, having fun. At the end, where I'm going to show you one other thing that I really wasn't going to show you, but I think I better show you because nobody's seen it except Visalia this weekend. We'll get into that in just a little. But I think you have some things to demo, don't you? This is very cool. This is very cool.
Am I plugged in? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Amateur transceivers through the years. I'm just going to go ahead and talk here if I can. Let me give that other microphone. Well, I can use this one. This is fine. Amateur transceivers through the years evolved such along with technology. And we had in the 70s radios that were famous like the TS-940. What are you doing with my antenna, Bob? I had an antenna. And you QSY'd it there. Okay. In the 70s, you could do absolutely nothing to your transmitter passband. You were fixed. Oh, yeah, you could get in there with a screwdriver and start messing with the place of where the carrier appeared by the filter, kind of like IF shift, which appeared in the 70s with the TS-820 initially. But we had really no way to adjust things. That's where Bob came up with some of these elements, and we'll get to that in just a second in conjunction with a smaller radio. But it was the development of digital signal processing and microprocessor control that allowed you to make adjustments on the fly to radios. It really brought about a new era in what we could do on the air. Now, Yaesu, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, went to a system whereby, through microprocessor control, you could adjust the carrier point, the equivalent of IF shift on the receive side, only applied to the transmitter side. So you could go like you can with IF shift, only on the transmitter. So you could roll off lows or roll off highs depending on your voice, your environment, your microphone. And that was a great development. But when digital signal processing came along, we started getting the whole spectrum of potential adjustments. Now, right now, I am speaking to you in a wide bandwidth with literally with speech processor on. And this is on the air on sort of dummy loads. And we are transmitting in something that would be disaffectionately called a hi-fi bandwidth. And this is all well and good when we're rag-chewing. But my goodness, you know, if we're trying to get through a DX pileup, we would really like to be a little more aggressive. So ICOM put in a couple of neat things on here. First off was the ability to diddle with the treble and the bass controls. And for example, if we wanted to have more fidelity, oh yeah, we can do the Art Bell thing. Who loves you, baby? 1, 2, 3, 4. Hey, there goes another one of them UFOs. Maybe I'll get on this one and go for a ride. Or if we want to get more aggressive, we can roll off that low end. Okay, so let's roll off this low end now. And I've already got full treble kicked in. We could always drop that down, and I hate that sound. That's where we get way too mellow like Bob was. But how many people have we heard on the air that sound like this, and you can almost tell what they're saying? So, but Chip's got the microphone now, so we're going to kick up the treble all the way, and now we're going to play some other games. Not only can you do treble and bass, but you can adjust bandwidth. Now, Fletcher Munson taught us that we want to accentuate the higher frequencies. Well, we've got a filter in this radio, an SSB filter, that's going to limit us to some degree on what we can do. But we can, within reason, goose that towards the high side while maintaining intelligibility and play towards Fletcher Munson. Enhance the high frequency so that when signals are weak, we will sound much better, or at least we'll be audible. So let's go instead to about a 3 kilohertz bandwidth here. Let's go to about a 2.3, I think I've got this set for. Now, this is more aggressive, but if signals are weak, you're thinking, well, I can pick that up. I can pick that up. I can pick that up. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Going back wide. Let's get that bass going here, and we'll see just exactly what we sound like if we kick that bass away. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Well, it's not going to stand up very bad. Think of all the noise and everybody calling. You're not going to hear that so well. Okay, now let's go.
There's the medium. Kilo 7, Juliet Alpha. I'm punching through a pileup. It sounds like my shorts are too tight. Yes, it does. But I can adjust myself as I fill out that QSL card while everybody else is still calling. What have we done?
We have increased the power density by narrowing the bandwidth. You narrow the bandwidth, the power's got to go someplace. It's a balloon. It's like building a Yagi. You squeeze an omnidirectional pattern, and power's got to go someplace. Well, it goes further out. It works at audio, too. But not only are we increasing the power density by simply squeezing, we are squeezing in a manner that is a curve fit to Fletcher Munson. We are creating a curve fit to those higher frequencies, the higher end of the SSB envelope, and it's a double whammy that makes just a few dB of goosing in that direction, or even 300 hertz shift, very, very effective in busting through a DX pileup.
That matches the capability of the radio. We have big radios. We have small radios. We have wide microphones. We have not so wide microphones. And they don't always match up. You get a great big wide microphone that goes from 30 hertz on the low side to 16,000 hertz on the high side. And we've got a little tiny radio like an IC7000, which is a wonderful radio. But, you know, it's got a little microprocessor in there, and it's not quite as big as the microprocessor in this big $12,000 beast right here that Luke will be happy to sell you. Because of that, the analog-to-digital conversion, all those ones and zeros that get created out of this curve of audio, sometimes are a little bit in the headache mode trying to cope with all this frequency response. And the result is not always pretty. And the same thing can happen. It's not just a digital signal processing. The smaller radios, for reasons of size, have smaller IF filters in them, and sometimes it is difficult for them to handle this wide range of frequencies. I'm going to switch radios now and pull my transmit antenna out of the back of that guy and plug it into my faithful little FT817. This is a wonderful little radio. I take it everywhere with me. And I'm going to give you a nice high-fidelity microphone to listen to. Nice wide frequency range on this nice little radio.
Set that down. I don't know if I'm still on frequency, so you'll forgive me. 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Julia.
That sounds all right. That's like what I hear a lot of times.
Hello, 1234, K7, Japan, America.
Oh, boy, that sounds really good, doesn't it? All right. This is a professional microphone. This is the 4-pin. You'll have to get the 3-pin version in for just a second. You can plug that into there. But let's see what happens if we plug in a microphone, like Bob described a minute ago. Transmit audio and IF sections of this little radio.
1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 3, 2, 1, K7 Juliet Alpha.
I haven't touched a mic gain, I haven't touched a thing, but now we are not blasting this poor radio's input with way too much audio bandwidth.
The result, hello, 1, 2, 3, 4, get on frequency chip, 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, 3, 4. Kilo 7, Japan, America.
I can go right again. This is a live bandwidth right now. 1, 2, 3, 4. This is a broadcast. This is the microphone Bob was up here talking to you on just a second ago in the wide bandwidth.
But it's too much microphone for the IF filter. Little switch going to the HC5. It rolls off at 300 hertz right where the IF filter rolls off here.
Kilo 7, Juliet Alpha. This is the voice of Garden Grove, California.
How about this other microphone we were just using, the one that sounded like garbage?
Oh, it sounds very good when you use it through a system that it'll work on. It's the same microphone. Yep, it's all about what you do with it.
So it's very important that you, in your shopping, in your specification of microphones, think about your radio, think about your objectives, and match the microphone to the radio you're using. If you don't have all this highfalutin stuff on something like an IC76, 77, 7800, or the ASU rigs with the parametric EQ, which is a lot of fun, if you don't have these kinds of things, think a lot about doing the EQ in the microphone. These HC5 and HC4 elements can be very, very effective when properly applied. But if you go wider, use a broadcast microphone, you better be ready to have some way to tame it. Otherwise, you get the results that are right here. And people get this and they say, well, this microphone's defective. Well, it's not defective. It just wasn't the right microphone for what you're trying to do. It's interesting stuff. And Fletcher Munson is what it's all about in terms of your ability to be heard on the other side of a pileup. Bob, I'll hand back to you.
Okay. Well, we like to do these things because a lot of times people think, oh, that isn't right. That can't be right. Well, it has to be right. You just heard it live. We try to do things because we either have it in our possession or our buddies have this microphone and you plug it in your radio. It's a different radio, a different voice, a different room. And so you have to pay attention to what you're doing with the microphone. There's a couple of other things that I want to say in closing here, and that's about ICOM. ICOM, when they came to this country in the early 70s, had this very, very strange way of doing things. First of all, they had no preamplifier. That's why they called them zero models, 720, 730, 740. There's no microphone preamp in that radio. It's line level in. The preamp was built in the microphone, and that was a pretty silly thing to do, but they thought they'd be different about it. Well, finally, they found out they should move that into the radio EPCOM to 735, and from there on, they've always had this phantom power, 8 volts down the line, which causes more problems than you can shake a stick at, RFI, all kinds of other problems, and we were honored to work with them. Several years ago when the 7800 was being introduced, they wanted me to build a microphone just for that, so I did. And not only was I able to work with them with the microphone we built, but I got them to raise the gain up to almost what Yaesu and Kenwood is, and they still wanted to hang that phantom power in there. So you have to be careful with ICOM. You can cause some real serious damage if you go shorting around to the the pin one of the audio. But we built a microphone for it. We built an element for the all of the radios, our ICM. That's why we call it ICM. It's about as close to ICOM I can get without trade infringement. But it really plays on ICOM radios, all of them. Not the 720, 30, 40, not the zero models, because, well, some of them maybe, but usually not. And what you have to do there is go out and buy yourself a little Behringer. I mentioned it a minute ago. This is the most amazing thing, and I don't think you should be able to have a ham radio license without it. It is absolutely an amazing $50 gadget, $60 thing. Unbelievable. I don't know how they do it. You can't build the power supply for that. And this little guy allows us to do all kinds of things. It's a preamp. It's a three-band equalizer. It's one of the best headphone amplifiers I've ever heard. I use one for receiving. I don't need any EQ on my radio because the radios already have them today, and the microphones that we build don't need much EQ. But I use it for receive. It's amazing. I'll have four receivers plugged into this thing. It comes out of there into a little brick amplifier. You buy them at any truck stop, little 30, 40-watt amp. But you see, the amplifier that you buy there is only like 0.1 or 0.05% distortion. The amplifiers in all of these transceivers is like 8 to 10%. Trust me. And you're going to say, oh, Heil, not mine. No, you're full of crap. And you're going to argue this. I'll hear it on the air tonight. Oh, it's full of crap. Mine isn't. Well, you come to my place, we'll put it on a distortion analyzer, and we'll show you. You see, they don't print all of that. Have you ever seen it printed? No. They say it, yeah. So the deal is, you come out of the back of the radio, the product detector, line out, line in, drive that clean little amp and a pair of JBL studio monitors. You will never hear your radio like that. It is amazing. The headphone amp is so clean. Because when you get a whole bunch of pileups going, that just distorts the nonsense out of a headphone amp. Because the headphone amp's only about a half a watt, if that. So you see, these are things you can play with. These are things you can experiment with, and they're really cool. And we think everybody should have one of these because then you can record in and out. Oh, you can do all kinds of things with them. Behringer, UB-802. And you can buy them. There's several ham dealers that carry them now, but you can go to your friendly music shop and buy them and all that kind of stuff. Got two other things I'm going to tell you about. First of all, how many people own some of these? A lot of you. How many of you people realize that when I designed this thing, 15 years ago, everything in it's replaceable, but it's also adjustable. And once in a while, I'll have a guy say, wow, this thing is way too hard on my ears. It's pushing me. Well, fine. This is steel. Don't worry. It's not some plastic piece of Walmart junk. There's steel in there now. Will that fit your head? Well, no, there are people that's right.
Valio, this is for you.
But then you get little pinheads like me. Don't be afraid. You're not going to break it, and you can bring it back to where it's comfortable for you. All of our headsets do that. And as I said, everything in this is available from us. And I got this little switch on the side that says phase reversal. What does that do? It takes this side and puts it out of phase of this side. I told you if we had about 4 hours, we could talk about phasing. You know how a home theater system works? Did you ever think about this? You bring down two signals, left and right. You plug it into your Dolby decoder, and you end up with four signals. How do you do that? How do they put the dialogue in the center, left and right orchestra, and rear? How do they do that? Phasing, thank you. When they record the dialogue, Harrison Ford stands in front of a microphone in a studio that's out of phase from the orchestra. That's how he does it. I go, wait a minute. We can do that in this. It won't have Harrison Ford talking to you. But it moves the signal. It's the most amazing thing. You get into a pile up, especially CW, and you start listening. You close your eyes. You mentally dissect. You're trying to get that last country. And you flip the switch, and he goes from his pile up mush back here to pow, right here. You can absolutely move that signal in your head all by phase reversal. And it's on most of our headsets. It's pretty cool if you haven't listened to it. Very cool. And then, I've been 2 years on this little deal. We wanted to continue this thing of noise canceling. And noise canceling is a thing, it's a patent owned by the noise canceling technology people, NCT, who owns ClearSpeech. A few years ago, rumors apply, like, Heil bought ClearSpeech. No, I didn't buy ClearSpeech. They only rented my line and built some of their speakers. But we got so involved in the pro industry, I couldn't do it anymore, so I had to have them go somewhere else. Because I was working on this project that they alerted me to. They said, we got new technology coming on noise canceling. And there's several big manufacturers that's done it for years, but they're still using the old technology. So we got the new stuff. And I designed this for us. But first, I looked at it for the consumer industry, for airlines, whatever. It's got a volume control right on the headset, which is very handy. The on and off switch. That takes care of all the people riding on airplanes. But then I turned the corner. We tooled a brass insert deep inside, and I came up with the coolest boom that's ever been done. It took me almost 2 years to do this. And when we did it right. First of all, this boom is very light, and it'll do anything. It's wonderful. There'll be five booms, HC4, HC5, HC6, and the IC element. And
it's a secret.
Yeah, and a broadcast element for all the broadcasters. So we'll have various booms to fit all the different things, and absolutely the best noise-canceling headset I have ever heard. And yes, I own two pair of Boses, sorry. This thing is going to be amazing. It's going to be Dayton. We showed it at Visalia last week. Everybody's freaking out over it. They got to use it. And you just might be looking for it, called the Quiet Phone Pro. And we're very proud of this because it's taken a long time. And a lot of you guys have helped me design this and get it right. And it is right. And, yeah, it's got steel in it, and you can do that too and not break it. Yeah, it's important that we do all of this stuff. I want to do one other thing, and then we're going to show you another DVD that's pretty cool. I have a lot of guys say, well, Schumer microphones, what you do? Well, what just happened here? This is, you know, you see it everywhere. Well, what just happened is it just lost its life. I'm not playing games here. It's an SM58. And you got to be right here. Don't move. Because if you move, it's gone. Front to back, it's not that good. Well, why do people use it? Because this just blows it totally away. And if that doesn't blow it away, 35, we'll take Stevie Wonder's new microphone. This is the and I came up with this. But we did. It's 4 dB louder. It's got the most beautiful articulation. It's got the best balance of highs and lows. 40 dB a rear, and you don't have to sit right here. That's what Stevie likes about it. Charlie Daniels loves that part of it. Paul Rogers, Joan Baez is in love with this thing. It was really her that got me to build this. And the thing is, we can move around, and it's still there. It does not lose its tone. Try that with any microphone. How did I do it?
Amazing.
Thank you. You get these guys, well, you know, Rush Limbaugh uses that great microphone. He does. Oh, well, wait a minute. Something must be wrong here.
Ohio, you did something.
I did something wrong. That's right. because you see, we take that out of it. And it's like, oh my God, what just happened? What happened was right. It was putting all of the things together that was right. It wasn't listening to all the old guys that was doing the same thing. They moved to Mexico. They moved to China. They fired their R&D guys. They don't care about you. They don't care. They just care about the bean counters. Well, sorry about that. We're going to do this, and if we can maintain some kind of profitability, great. If we can't, I'll just go sit down and play my Wurlitzer pipe organ and be happy. And I do a lot of that. I got a real special thing that I want to do. Is the projector still on? Okay. If you guys have not seen this, well, you're about to, and it's really cool. Really cool. You're going to recognize a few people here.
All righty. It's Friday night. It's time for a new segment. We call Dinner for Four, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dinner for Four, the game where we test just how hungry our audience members are. We don't really. It's just an excuse to give away some dinners. Who would like to play? I'm told we pre-selected the people. This young lady, hi, how are you?
Hi, good.
Hi, what is your name?
Madeline.
Madeline, your lovely smile. Madeline, where are you from?
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon. What do you do up there?
I work in a mortgage company. I'm a loan processor, primary residential.
Oh, all right. And do you say no? Can you say, I'm sorry?
No. We don't turn anybody down.
Really?
No.
Well, you must be very popular.
Oh, yes.
Let me ask. Do you have a cell phone? Do you have a cell phone?
Yeah.
And I imagine your business, text messaging is a huge part.
Yes.
All right. Okay. I want to show you what we're going to play here. Okay. We found the fastest text messenger in the country. Let's bring him out. Ben Cook and his friend Jason. Let's bring him out. Ben and Jason. Come on.
Hello.
And thanks for dressing for the show, fellas. We appreciate it. Okay. Ben, tell us about your record.
I typed a 160-character message in 57 seconds.
Okay.
Very quick. Wow.
And you accepted the message. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. It is.
So you don't really do anything.
It could be tough sometimes, right. But...
Okay. Now we're going to see just how fast this technology is. Let's bring out Ken Miller and Chip Margelli. Come on out here, fellas. You might guess by the way they're dressed. You see, Ken and Chip, they are two Morse code operators. You know what Morse code is?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You know, okay. How long you guys been doing Morse code?
38 years.
38 years.
43 years in ham radio.
43 years in ham radio. Okay. We're going to give each team a card with the same sentence on it. Who do you think will be the fastest to get the message to their partner? Morse code or text messaging?
Text messaging.
You think text messaging will beat Morse code? How old is Morse code?
170 years.
170 years. 170 years. Okay. All right, gentlemen, let's sit down at our desks. Okay. Now, in front of you is a card. Don't turn it over just yet. They both have the same sentence on it. When I say ready, set, go, when I say go, flip over your card and send the message to your partner at the other desk. Okay? Ready, set, go! Yell out as soon as you have the message, and then read me the message. You can hear the Morse code. Can you hear it going on?
Yes, I can. Okay.
Very exciting. Gets less exciting the more it goes on. Let's see who is faster. Would you read me your message, sir?
I just saved a bunch of money on my car insurance.
That is the message you sent, okay? Very good. Okay, there you have. Ben and Jason, I'm sorry you were beaten by 140-year-old technology. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, and you also lost, but we have a consolation prize.
Ooh.
It's the same crappy prize you would have gotten had you won. Do you like Thai food?
I love Thai
this
food.
This is the Chadaka Thai restaurant. It's the best Thai food in Burbank. Actually, it's the only Thai food in Burbank. That's dinner for four. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. All right. Who else would like to play?
So at Heil Sound, we may know microphones, but we know the code, too.
We'll be right back to the Bob Heil Audio Seminar in Las Vegas, Nevada, right after this. If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna, and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Trans World Adventurer 4040 Array Box in center section only, right now only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Trans World Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide. And in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with a deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Trans World Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Trans World Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Trans World Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. As you're listening to this broadcast recorded in Las Vegas, Nevada, the Bob Heil Audio Seminar, keep in mind one thing, and that is if you hear pauses or there all of a sudden the audio disappears or it sounds a little disjointed, it's because Bob is disconnecting microphones and connecting microphones. And we were connected to the PA system, Mike, and you're not. So when he disconnects a mic, it goes dead. We in the room could still hear him talking, but you'll notice a few things like that. Well, it's not bad, but believe me, you're going to enjoy listening to this seminar. The other thing is this. We are on iTunes. If you're listening by means of shortwave radio, you can get this broadcast in the form of a podcast off of iTunes. And, of course, off of our website as well. And what I'm going to do is I'm putting this up on iTunes and on our website, minus any audio processing. That way you can hear the full effect of all the things that Bob is doing. So let's get back to Las Vegas, Nevada, and Bob Heil's audio seminar.
It's been our privilege to be before you tonight. And if you have any questions, we'll be glad to take them at this time. Yes, back in the back.
Okay, I'm not sure perfect is the way it's called, because back in the old days, and there were two comments about CW and one about phone.
Oh boy, here we go.
CW, we used to put hair on the signal by taking a photo of the past, we could reduce it until they have a little buzz off. We got two better that way. So that's not T9, that's just
T8 and a half.
Because your ear would recognize that in relation to static. Now, in voice, we found that drive by a lot of time in Knoxville, walking through the fast band.
Oh, yes.
So sometimes noise has a shape to it or a tone factor to it that isn't flat, as you might be painted, whatever you call it, color you might want to call it. And I find that you're always going to listen to the top of the signal, because the rest is white noise static. And often I feel that introducing some distortion at certain frequencies may help you build it. But, you know, the process is climbing up real high, and you don't have to worry about that. But I know, like when I go to a Turner record, you play that on a Class A amplifier, and it seems like your music is simplified, it's not there. If you listen, I can see the Turner on an AV amplifier that isn't on a Class A. The music gets busy, sounds good, and you can recognize your voice easier.
Well, yeah, those are very valid points. I mean, in an earlier day, especially when I was running Collins gear, you know, and you're running split and you're not slaved, and I was having trouble getting through a pileup. Oh, the best thing to do is, you know, you start sending your call and you grab the VFO knob a little, and the DX is going to find you right quick. And I suppose the same thing is valid. You could, the notch filter through the pass band, especially, or playing with the equalization, changing your characteristics. Oh, I think those are very valid little tricks for getting you through under tough conditions. Absolutely. And there are all sorts of effects that you can do like that. That's a very valid point. And operator fatigue, of course, is a huge problem on both sides of the circuit. And frankly, after a 48-hour contest, the last 2 hours of voice, I'm grabbing that EQ and I'm trying to get rid of every ounce of bass because of
Seeker Gondrist, when is this thing going to be over?
Yeah, Wayne. Yes. Yeah, it's all kinds of tricks. Before there was digital signal processing and we could synthesize all these things, they had to do tricks like introducing noise to knock the ringing down, play in the time domain. And time domain is a big thing for a lot of these microphone elements, too. We don't like to equalize more than we want to, and so we've played with the diaphragm thickness to improve the transient response time. You want the S's, the T's, all those high-frequency things to come through, but why should you have to equalize heavily to make them come through if the microphone element responds fast enough? You don't have to equalize heavily, and so it sounds natural, but the high frequencies are there and they come through right here in the black. I'll get you in a second.
Yeah, I'm interested in using low-level AM out of the iPhone. So one of those elements.
One of these elements attached to a Heathkit Warrior. I would use, you know, one of our dynamics, and then I would go into some sort of an external EQ, either a Behringer or one of the W2IHY boxes, and goose that big time. Wayne, have you got to comment on that particular thing? Yeah, but that's what you need. We need to hit that hard because that low-level AM and the narrow bandwidth, it sounds like this. It sounds really... But yeah, you've got to goose that high side. Yes, back here in the back, you had a question.
No.
Not really. It's what they've always done, and it's very cool.
But that's changing.
Yeah. Yeah, this is business. The Stevie Wonder DVD is cool, and Charlie Daniels swapping out all of his microphones. We've got everybody from Slash at one end of the spectrum, you know, to Charlie and Stevie. And you think Stevie Wonder can probably hear? He's been in the music world for what, 40 some years. He's heard good, he's heard bad, and he's heard it all. And when he takes about three or four bars of a song, and he jumps back and says, "What am I using now? That's what I want to sound like." And PR35, it took this just that long, and he had his sound guys hopping. Any more questions? We can catch you. Oh, yes, right here, back here in the black.
I want to find out, I have a motorcycle in my radio on the motorcycle. Have you been doing anything with the motorcycle?
Well, first of all, you're after some articulation. You got a lot of noise. And the HC4 is probably the worst sounding microphone in the world. And I get a lot of guys say, "Why in the world did you build such a crummy sounding thing?" Don't tell that to the DX crowd. Don't say that to a contester, which they'll do anything for that last country. And it's the super articulation of that 2,000 cycle spike that gets them through, as you heard a while ago. So what we do with the motorcyclists is we take a pair of those, cement them back to back, put them in your helmet right here, if you've got a full case helmet, and wire them out of phase. The background noise, the motor goes away because it rolls off at 600 cycles, which is an awful sounding thing. But man, does it cut through, and it's not going to pick up that motor noise, and that wind noise is bad. So a lot of guys doing motorcycles have been very happy with that.
Here's the HC4.
Kello 7 Juliet Alpha. That low frequency roll off is what you want to get rid of the motor sound. And yet, you know what? It sounds just fine.
And it's not going to sound like this. You can't do that on a motorcycle, but you can do that real easy. And taking a pair of those back to back works great. And the guys are using HC5s. It's a little more mellow, and that works really good. So you might want to talk to that. Talk about that. Yes.
I use a surplus
tank
pipe on mine. It works fine.
Yeah, that's right. There you go, Tom. Phasing. Everybody else building microphones has four little holes, and they rely on those four little holes to pick up the surrounding audio, and it goes into the phasing plug. I said, you know, if we could get more into that, so the whole bottom is empty. The whole bottom is cut out of it, and we bring it up from the bottom, and the entire audio around is not just a little ring, but it's a whole plethora of.
I will talk in a very low voice into this end of the microphone, K7JA 1234, 1234.
And then I will shout into this end of the microphone. You're hearing me here, but not over there.
It's a very effective technique. And the microphone sounds pretty good, too.
Yeah. It's a great-sounding microphone. And, again, all those pieces of science are in it. That's why it's got a lot of side entrance to it, not just a little, like any of these microphones. The ball, I put it away a while ago, but the ball microphones, they just have little holes, and that's it. This has a whole array, about an inch and a half, that brings them up to the bottom. That's... there again, phasing, out of phase, hello. Yep.
Do you make recommendations for specific radios?
Yeah, it's on our website, heilsound.com. Look, it's over 100 pages on that site.
Otherwise, it's just experimenting.
Yeah, but go there first. It really helps.
With some of the new technology used to improve phasing, you talked about different old and new technology in phasing.
On the headphones.
What is it that you can actually do that's different in the phasing?
Well, the phasing, the actual science doesn't change. It's just the fact that they can apply it into the new chips a lot better. And it's the problem before is they're trying to use so much DSP stuff, and it gets real confused when it's got all this stuff running through it. So they've been more focused and precise with the new chips to receive that rear audio. I don't think I said this, but do you know how a noise-canceling headset works? It's got two little microphones, one inside the headphone. We're not talking about the boom. We're talking deep inside the speaker is a little microphone, two of them, that listen to the outside audio. Out of phase. And so we take that out-of-phase signal and mix it with the in-phase signal from the program, and the ambient sound is gone, and it really works. Oh, absolutely. It's 4 dB louder, and it's got a lot of low end, but it is miraculous. I'm telling you, it's the best thing that I've ever heard. And it's, what's that? In here? The roll-off here is 40.
No, we've got a set on the switch. Yeah.
Well, yeah. There's a switch in the back of it, which is kind of cool. And we did this because it's so hot. And when we use it in the recording studios or we use it on live stages, sometimes we want to notch 120 cycles, or then we want to notch 60 cycles. It doesn't have all that booming low end. So we can do that right at the microphone. The engineers love it. Here it is, full range, 40 to out to about 18,500. Nope, it's a PR-35.
That thing sounds like it's getting it on. It's got a real healthy mid-range, so
if we don't have a 50 dB of dynamic range, because a lot of symbols, we only got 10 dB of dynamics, that thing puts the mid-range up there where I might hear the thing with some symbols out in the pocket. I have a disagreement with you about power. It's only going to be brief, but I force range between 50 and 100 watts and 100 and 200 watts, and the guy doing the power, he can see the difference between 1500 and 100 and 200, very noticeable. Oh, and force range,
Right, and those lower levels, it's true, because it's more noticeable, but it's still 3 dB. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. 100 doesn't get it, but you get up around 2, it works.
But if I might add some commentary, you're speaking to the very point we're making about Fletcher Munson. You're going from 50 to 100 watts and a little short 4 foot tall antenna, and somebody's using the right microphone, those lower levels are going to be picked up more effectively because of the high frequencies. You go from 50 to 100 watts and the guy's down the street, you know, I don't think you're going to see that difference. It's speaking to Fletcher Munson, and I really think
if you want to do something, you go look up Fletcher Munson and study that, and it'll answer your question for you. Because at different levels, we hear differently. I'm telling you, that's why the kids like to hear rock and roll at 140 dB, because everything is there. You get down at 40, 50 dB, whew, the low end's gone. It's just really different sounding, and you want to play with that. Yes?
Yes, Bob. What's your opinion of the original D104 crystal cartridge?
Oh, for what it was designed for, it was great. For what it was designed for, it has no lows in it, and it was made by the Brush Company when they had 10-watt PA amplifiers for bingo halls. Oh, no, I'm serious about this because I've studied it. And what happened, just exactly what we're doing today with the HC4, we have to use all of that power to make you understand whether it was an O or a B or an I. And so the D104 had this big spike at 1800, annoying as hell. But it was there. It was there. But it had this spike that was just like this. And it took that little 10-watt amplifier and really made it articulate. Then everything kind of laid low for a while. And the CBers came in. And they liked the look of it. And then they plugged it into a solid-state low-impedance amp, shorted out the front end of it, and so it never worked very well. So what did a static do? Everybody said, oh, it has a preamp. No, it doesn't. I'm going to wake you up and tell you a horrible thing that you're going to dream about tonight and say, God, it's a nightmare. It is not a preamp. If you got a D104 and you think it's got a preamp, you're wrong. It is an electronic active impedance matcher. It is not a preamp. And it bugs the hell out of me when people try to jam that thing into all kinds of stuff. And if they only knew how to control that crystal element, it would be great. I mean, I looked at doing crystal elements, but we just can't get the crystals because what happened there were the crystals are now being sold to the medical industry and are getting big dollars for them, a lot more than you would pay for it in a microphone, and you just can't buy them anymore at reasonable cost. But you can make it work. What you really want to do is buy one of our HC104 kits. We have all of the mechanisms and an HC5, and it works so good, and it matches all the new front ends. And it works great if you want to do that. And it works on a lot of other things. Well, I thank you all for coming. This has been really great. Tom, thanks for being persistent. I told you to lean on us till we made this. Thanks very much. Okay. Just remember, you can always get a hold of us. It's very important. When you see one of our boxes, it always says, built by those who care in Fairview Heights. And that's not a lie. We've been doing it since 1967. And you can call us. You can send us an email. I get hundreds of them a day. Chip gets hundreds a day. We get all kinds of phone. And guess what? We answer you. And I get these guys, you didn't answer me. Well, you know, there are things like spam folders and all kinds of crap that happens, and we try that, you know, try to take care of it. But if it gets to us, we answer you. Always pick up the phone. Forget the damned email. 618-257-3000. Yeah, it's going to cost you a quarter. But then you get to talk to one of us, and we can really help you. But we're always there, and we really appreciate your support, your business, and more than anything, that your recognition that I think we're doing this.
Week after week, you hear us talk about Trans World Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews. Or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you. How many of you would like to operate 80 meters, but you can't because of antenna restrictions? Well, that's over. You can operate 80 meters right now. You can operate from your home, your apartment. You can take it on the road with you. It's the brand new Transworld Antennas 8080. Go to their website and check it out. transworldantennas.com. This is a portable antenna, but it can be a permanent antenna. It's stealth. It's not a low-profile antenna. This thing is a performance-driven piece of engineering. You need to see it. It will be at Dayton, and you need to hear one of these on the air. If you want to operate 80 meters and you can't, I love the 80-meter band. I can't imagine not being able to operate on 80. But nonetheless, if you're in that position, don't stay in that position. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. Go up there and take a look at their brand new 8080 and look for it at Dayton. As a QSO listener, we really need to hear from you. We would like to know you're listening. We'd like to know how you feel about the radio show. We'd like to hear some suggestions. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? And you can do that by going to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. There's a place that says email Ted or some such nonsense as that's on the page. Click on that button and send me an email because I want to know what you think. I want to know what you want to hear more of, less of, what you think about the program, where you're listening. How is it coming in on the shortwave? Is it coming in real good where you're at? And what about the time? Is this a good time? Would you prefer it on at a better time? And what would that better time be? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll even send you a QSL card if you'll send us an email. Once again, go to tedrandall.com. That's TEDRANDALL.com. And where it says Contact Ted, just click on that little tab and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening to QSO. Normally, Linda Moulton Howe doesn't make an appearance on QSO, but I will tell you, she is an award-winning, Emmy Award-winning science editor for Premier Radio Networks. You've heard her on Coast to Coast, I'm sure, on the Art Bell Show and on George Norrie's show. And, of course, she's part of our team here. And she has the latest stuff on sunspots. So listen up to Linda Moulton Howe.
A sunspot is a region of intense magnetic activity on the sun's surface that is cooler than the rest of the sun. That's why sunspots appear dark. Those dark sunspots appear in cycles of about 11 years. In between spots on the sun are quiet times called solar minimums. The last solar cycle minimum number 23 began in May 1996. The next solar cycle number 24 was expected to start sometime in 2007 with a new crop of sunspots. But it is now April 2009, and this is the most spotless sun in a century.
Scientists did not start numbering solar cycles until 1755, after a mini ice age in Europe that was linked to a nearly spotless sun for 70 years, a period referred to as the Maunder Minimum. The Maunder Minimum, named after solar physicist Edward Maunder, was a 70-year-long period roughly from 1645 to 1715, when sunspots became exceedingly rare on the sun. During one 30-year period within the Maunder Minimum, astronomers observed only about 50 sunspots, compared to 40,000 to 50,000 sunspots in modern times. A patch of magnetism on the sun was declared by NASA to be the first official sunspot of the new solar cycle 24. The spot was in a high latitude on the sun with reverse polarity from the previous solar cycle 23. With that discovery, solar scientists expected 2008 would bring more sunspots as the new solar cycle developed intensity towards solar maximum expected in 2011 to 2012. But out of 365 days in 2008, 266 were without sunspots. So far in 2009, January had 25 sunspot-free days, February had 23 sunspot-free days, and March had 28 sunspot-free days. Solar cycle 23 began in a May 1996 minimum. So, by April 2009, it has been 13 years between minimums and still no increasing sunspots. The last time a solar cycle has gone 13 years between minimums was solar cycle 15 in 1902 to 1913. Recently, I talked about the unusual 13 years between minimums in solar cycles 23 and 24. With John Davis, Ph.D., manager of the Space Science Office at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Dr. Davis had planned to launch an instrument in September 2008 to measure the sun's magnetic fields. But he needs active sunspots in order to have fields to measure. So now he and his fellow scientists are still waiting to launch. Frustrated, Dr. Davis now wonders if there will even be sunspots this summer of 2009.
6 months ago, my prediction was that it would have turned up by now because I was comparing it to other past cycles. And so I was saying by April that we would have substantial activity.
Which is now, April 2009.
Yes, I know. And I had, but now I postponed it again now to July. But I don't know if that's going to be any better. My guess is that it could go on, as I said, for quite a long time, maybe another 12 months. Although within that 12 months, I would not be at all surprised to see one or two active rotations, and then it will drop back down again. That's what has happened in the past, but that's no guarantee that that's what's going to happen in the future.
And what would you, in an educated guess, expect from the maximum? When would you expect us to maybe have X40 flares, and for about how long?
Well, it would go on the same 11-year cycle, so that wouldn't change. The maximum, if it comes, it may be, I cannot tell you whether it's going to be a large cycle or a small cycle. The suggestion is that it probably will be a fairly small cycle, and that will be 3 or 4 years from now. If it doesn't do that, I don't know what it's doing.
Well, let me ask it this way. Originally, in my very first interviews with other solar physicists, the solar max in solar cycle 24 was expected to peak in 2011 to 2012. Is that still on track?
That still could be very well be on track, except it's probably unlikely that it's going to be as high as we predicted before. It may be at the low end of the scale, not as intense. But as soon as you say something, the sun knows what it's going to do, and it doesn't tell us. My guess is, if I was going to put money on it,
right?
I would say that the next two solar cycles are actually going to be quite small. As I pointed out before, the next minimum will also be long. But that's because that's what it has done twice in the past.
Okay.
Four of the last five cycles have been very big cycles, and that's somewhat unusual.
And is the bottom line here that the sun is still baffling even to our world's best solar physicists?
It's baffling to me. I can't speak to the world's best solar physicists, but we can only say the consensus opinion did not expect this.
Astrophysicist Mark Miesch, PhD and staff scientist at the High Altitude Observatory in the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, studies the solar dynamo, which is how the sun generates the magnetic fields that make sunspots. He also wonders what's going on inside the sun and how much longer it will be before sunspots emerge again.
It's a fascinating time. It's the quietest sun in a century since the solar minimum of 1913. And it's still possible the next cycle might be large. It's still possible that coming off a deep minimum, the next cycle might be stronger than the previous one. But the relatively long minimum here, it wasn't predicted, but it's not completely unprecedented.
Meaning that by 2011 to 2012 at solar max in solar cycle 24, that we still could have strong X40 flares in a strong solar max, even with this quiet sun in the beginning?
Yes, that's possible. Different models say different things. So according to some models, a deep solar minimum would imply that the upcoming maximum will be weaker than usual as well. But other models say differently. It could go either way.
What does your work in studying the sun indicate to you?
Well, I wouldn't want to go on the record with a prediction. My work tends to indicate that it's largely random. I study how stars build magnetic fields. The sun and other stars we see in the galaxy, there's many stars that exhibit magnetic activity like the sun. And the one thing that they all have in common is what we call convection. In the outer part of these stars, we know convection from daily experience. Warm air rises, cooler air sinks. And if you heat a fluid from below, like in the sun, so energy is released by nuclear reactions in the core, and that heats the fluid from below, so you have overturning motions. And these fluid motions are what generate magnetic fields. That constant churning motion inside the sun is what builds magnetic fields. The energy of motion of the fluids is converted into magnetic energy, and that's how. And the turbulent nature of those fluids, they're very chaotic. So that's what gives you the chaotic part of the sun. That's why each solar cycle is not the same as the last, because there's a certain random element.
And in the context of what you study, a sunspot is what?
A sunspot is a manifestation of the magnetic field in the deep interior of the sun. In fact, it was a century ago. It's the 100th anniversary of when the American astronomer George Ellery Hale first detected magnetic fields on the sun, and it was in sunspots. That was in 1908 to 1909. And so he was the first to show that sunspots are a magnetic phenomenon. They come from magnetic fields. And we now think that those magnetic fields originate deep in the interior of the sun, and then they rise through something that we call magnetic buoyancy. There's tubes of magnetism that are less dense than their surroundings, and they rise like a hot air balloon and then poke out the surface of the sun. And that's what we think a sunspot is. They're a way to probe the magnetism below the surface of the sun.
So when the sun is going 268 days with no sunspots, what does that say to you about what is happening deep inside of the sun?
It says that there's no strong enough fields to become buoyant like hot air balloons. So the sun isn't generating these strong magnetic concentrations of magnetic field. But that doesn't mean solar magnetism has ceased. Just like the Earth has a magnetic field around it, the sun has a magnetic field around it. It's pushed out by the solar wind and envelops the whole solar system. And there are cosmic rays, are particles that are generated by supernovae and other things in the galaxy. But the sun has a magnetic cage around all the planets and deflects those cosmic rays. So at times when the magnetic activity of the sun is small, more cosmic rays get in. And when magnetic activity is high, less cosmic rays get in. That comes to the Earth, and they create isotopes in certain elements like beryllium and carbon. And you can measure that back 10,000 years, and beryllium is in ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica. And carbon is contained in tree rings if you find an old tree. So by looking at those isotopes, we can trace things back a long time. And that tells us that the solar cycle was still going on in the Maunder Minimum. So the solar cycle, the sun's protective bubble around all the planets, was going up and down every 11 years just like it is now. But yet there were no sunspots. So it's a fascinating puzzle. Some models say that sunspots are an integral part of why the 11-year cycle can't proceed without sunspots. But these isotope data during the Maunder Minimum suggest that might not be the case. So us having a prolonged minimum now is exciting from a scientific point of view.
And that we still could have a large solar max out of this very long, quiet sun.
Yeah, there are times in history. You can go back to times when we've had prolonged minima, and the maximum that comes out is relatively strong.
Is there any potential danger to Earth surface life of the sun going for an indefinite period of time without sunspots?
Not really. No, like I said, there is still solar magnetism. We call the magnetic field that surrounds the Earth makes a protective bubble that we call the magnetosphere. The similar protective bubble around the sun and all the planets is called the heliosphere. There's still solar magnetism permeating the heliosphere even during the Maunder Minimum and even during extended minima. So if there were no sunspots for 70 years, there would still be a heliosphere.
But it does shrink.
Yeah, the amount of magnetism in the heliosphere does go down when solar activity goes down. It lets more cosmic rays in.
And what is the danger of more cosmic rays coming to the Earth?
Not significant from a health perspective. The biggest impact that solar activity has is at times of strong solar activity. You wouldn't want to take a transpolar flight. For instance, an airline flight from New York City to Beijing, China, they go at pretty high latitudes. And if there's a lot of magnetic activity on the sun, it sends out particles in the solar wind, and those get funneled toward the poles by Earth's magnetic field. And that's what causes aurora. Aurora are nice to look at when you're in the safetiness of standing on the Earth's surface. But if you're in a plane in the stratosphere, you can get a significant dose of radiation if you fly through an aurora.
What about the guys that are up on the International Space Station?
Yeah, that's right. The space station itself is within the magnetosphere. It's within Earth's protective bubble. And its orbit is more toward the equator. It's more low latitudes. So actually, astronauts on the International Space Station would get less radiation than a high-altitude flight over the poles. However, if you went to the moon, that would be a different story. If you went outside the magnetosphere, astronauts on a deep space mission to the moon or Mars would certainly get a lot of solar radiation if there was a lot of magnetic activity. If we kick into a strong maximum, then it could become a threat again. But what usually happens is it's more of an economic issue than a health issue, because if there is a significant threat of increased radiation, what the planes will do is fly lower. And flying lower means more atmospheric drag, which means more fuel and possibly multiple stops, shorter flights. So it can cost the airlines money. High solar activity can disable satellites. So telecommunication satellites in particular can be disabled. So telecommunication companies would have to repair them or launch new ones. And also, high solar activity can disrupt power grids on the ground.
Do you have a sense yourself, based on what you study, of when you would expect to start seeing a lot of sunspots again?
From what I study turbulent fluids, and turbulence is inherently random and unpredictable. So my own experience says it's unwise to make forecasts of what a chaotic system is going to do.
Then why is there an 11 and 22-year cycle in the sun at all?
That is an excellent question, yes. There are random processes superposed on top of more ordered processes, and every star has a mixture of those. Our sun is particularly regular compared to other stars. You can look at other stars, and some of them have activity cycles like the sun. Some of them are just completely chaotic, and they don't have any rhyme or reason on what their magnetic activity is doing.
Well, what produces the cycle in our sun?
That is a question that people have been asking since for 200 years.
And nobody knows.
Well, there are certainly models, and it has to do with how the sun is stretched out. It has to do with differential rotation. The sun spins faster at its equator than at its poles. That tends to stretch out magnetic fields. If you have a magnetic field line that goes from the equator to the pole, but the equator spins around faster than the pole, that magnetic field line gets stretched out into an east-west direction, and it gets stronger and stronger.
How does the sun go faster at the equator than the poles?
That's another question that people have been working on for centuries, but it has to do, again, with this convection. As these motions go up and down over turn, they transport heat from the interior to the surface to make the sun shine. They create magnetic fields, and they also redistribute angular momentum. So the way in which they redistribute angular momentum in a spinning star makes the equator spin faster than the poles.
And why is it that the interior of the sun is so much hotter than the surface?
The interior of the sun is hotter than the surface. It's the nature of why a star is stable, that gravity pushes in, but you have to have an outward gradient of pressure. Pressure has to push out to balance gravity. So the center of the star has to have a higher pressure than the surface, or it'll implode.
Right now, anything could happen with the sun, including 70 years of another Maunder minimum?
Yeah, that's possible. I think it's unlikely, but it's possible.
But why do you say it's unlikely?
Because the modulation, I think, is random. The Maunder minimum was the only extended period like that in the last 400 years. The most exciting part of this for me is this is the deepest solar minimum of the space age. Since we have instruments to really monitor the sun and space weather and the whole magnetism in the heliosphere and how the sun interacts with the planets, we have more instruments now, telescopes, both in space and on the ground, monitoring this than ever before. And this minimum will tell us a lot about the nature of how the sun generates magnetic fields and about how those magnetic fields shape the solar corona and the heliosphere and how solar activity impacts the planets.
And that even out of a long minimum like this one, we still could have X40 flares as we get to 2011 to 2012?
It's possible, yes.
We love having Linda on as a guest. Linda Moulton Howe, Emmy award-winning science editor for Premier Radio Networks. And incidentally, why don't you drop her an email and let her know that you enjoyed listening to the Sunspot report there and all of the things that she was explaining along with her guests. We love having her on. You can reach her just simply, her email address is just earthfiles@earthfiles.com. That's earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Now, her website is earthfiles.com, but you can reach her by email, earthfiles@earthfiles.com, and just shoot her an email and let her know you're listening and how you appreciate her being on the air and bringing us up to date on the solar activity. That's going to do it for this edition of QSO, and a special thanks to all of our guests, Bob Heil and Chip Margelli, along with the Las Vegas Amateur Radio Club that allowed this event to take place and hosted it, and Emmy Award-winning science editor Linda Moulton Howe. Tune in next week, same time, same station for QSO.